Hello.
Hello, is this John?
This is John.
Yes, I'm with Vince Martin doing
yes.
this radio show. I called you because my Skype is having issues. So you mind if holding for a little bit?
Yeah, go ahead. I can work
thank
off
you.
This phone.
All right, thank you very much.
This is Vegas All-Net Radio, the final frontier of free speech.
Welcome to the Talk with Vince show, where we will explore the depths of your mind. Let's talk about spirituality, enlightenment, politics, ufology, conspiracy, even sex. No subject is off the table. You're with the Talk with Vince show here on VegasAllNetRadio.com. Now, here's your host, Vince.
Well, she seemed all right by dawn's early light, though she looked a little worried and weak. She tried to pretend he wasn't drinking again, but Daddy left the proof on her cheek. I was only 8 years old that summer, and I always seemed to be in the way. So I took myself down to the fair and town on Independence Day. The losing end. From the
talk about your revolution. It's an Independence Day. Let freedom ring. Vegas All Net Radio. Welcome to the Talk with Vince Show. I'm your host, Vince Martin, along with this lovely Susie Miyushu Baby Smith. And it's good to be back with you guys. I was out last week because of a cold, and I still got a slight cold. And, you know, it's just kind of funny because I haven't had a cold in 5 years. So I guess that was nature's way of shutting me up so that there could be no Talk with Vince last week. But we've got a very special show for you today, because we're going to be talking about liberating ourselves. We're going to be talking about regaining our independence. You just heard the song Independence Day. Well, today, for my listening audience, we're going to start upon that journey, and you are going to get some great information today, because we got a very, very special guest, John Durash, and he's here to talk about common law juries. And for those of you that don't know, especially for those of you in the overseas audience, in America, the jury is the highest authority of law in the land. A lot of people don't know that. They think it's the judge, they think the prosecutors, but no, we're judged by our peers, of the people, for the people, by the people. And the Fifth Amendment makes that possible. Today you're going to get a lesson on common law juries and the Fifth Amendment. John, how you doing, sir?
How you doing, Vince? Good to talk to you.
Oh, I'm doing great, man. And, you know, I've been on National Liberty Alliance website all week, and just the information that you have up there, oh my God, I got an education. I got a serious education.
That's the key thing here is, you know, as Jefferson said, if people expect to be ignorant and free, they expect what never was and never will be. So we do have to become informed. We have to really become educated on what our heritage is, and our heritage is natural law, also known as common law.
John, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started down this path.
Well, you know, about back in the late 90s, I had a problem with the IRS, and they kept chasing after me year after year and, you know, just annoying me with things, and they would never answer any of my questions. And so I got involved with a group called We the People. Some people, I'm sure, have heard of it. It's a nationwide movement with Robert Schultz. So I was early on in that in the late 90s. And he went through all the processes in court in order to bring these people back under the control, looking for due process and looking for redress of grievances. And he never got anywhere. And of course, back in the Ron Paul movement or revolution, I realized that that might be something I want to be involved with, because it was all about freedom. So I got involved with that, and then eventually, when you know the elections were over, I got involved with the Tea Party, and then a movement called I can't even remember the name. It was with the Committeemen. We started a movement here in New York called NewYorkCommitteeMen.org, and it was Primary Challenge was the name of the organization that got me involved with that. And that became a national movement, and people throughout the country have been working on that since. But about we discovered here in New York that they had expunged the elected committeemen, but they left it open with a facade. It appears as if an individual is being elected for each of the election districts, but that's not true. It's just a facade. They just go through the changes to make it look like that. And we discovered the actual elected committee man is still in election law, but they've expunged it. They don't talk about it, and they won't acknowledge the position. So we decided to sue New York State Board of Election because they wouldn't obey the law. And we started that process maybe about 3 years ago. We've been in the courts ever since. We've sued them a couple of times already, and we've been up to the appellate courts. And then we got involved with the common law during that time period because we realized that the system was set up in a corporate way that when you go into courts, they're really you're fighting against corporate charter, which ultimately is statutes. And not and you don't have the protection of the Constitution. So we realized that, and we started to use common law to make our battles. And so about, I don't know, 6-8 months ago, roughly at the beginning of this year, I guess it must be 8 months, we found a case called United States versus Williams. Anton Scalia had written for the majority. It was a 6-3 decision. And he spoke about the power and the authority of the grand jury. And he appears to have poured out his life research in this concerning the grand jury. And that's what set our focus on this. So we started in New York, and a couple of months into this thing, we were online, you know, meeting, and people were coming in from other states. And so we kind of got drafted into the national movement here. And now we have 21 grand juries here in New York State out of 62 potential, because we have 62 counties. And we are active in 48 of the 50 states. And I heard this morning, I haven't been able to check this out, we just picked up one of the other two states, so we should be in 49 now. We're very deep-rooted in many states. Florida's moving very quick, Pennsylvania, California. It's moving through the country like wildfire. We started off with a handful of people in the beginning of the year, and now we're in the many thousands across the nation in a huge movement to in a, really a race against time to save the republic before it collapses.
Now, do you have is there a movement here, organization here in Nevada, because that's where we are?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have people in Nevada. And I can't look on to, for some reason, the website's right down. Now, that part of the website is down. So the database isn't coming through. I have a call into my, you know, the guy who takes care of that. But, yeah, I believe we do have in Nevada. I think we have, I'm not sure whether it was Arizona or Nevada, but one of those states we have pretty much half the counties already on board.
It may be Arizona, because actually Alice brought you to my attention. And she's very active in the movement. And she told me that she had spent like 26 years in the district courts here in Nevada before she moved to Arizona.
Uh-huh.
Right. And before we get into the meat of the interview, because, you know, a lot of people don't know that the Tea Party was born of the Ron Paul movement.
Exactly.
Before it got hijacked.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say that it was hijacked. Some other people continued the movement, but it is true that the Tea Party has been hijacked. But the original intent and the grassroots coming up, a lot of Ron Paulers, you know, moved over into the Tea Party to sort of incorporate into there and try to bring the freedom movement there and educate people and so on. But, yeah, it is true from a national level. There seems to be almost that we have spokesmen, according to Fox News or CNN and so on. And, of course, you can't possibly really have these people who claim to be the leaders, because a true grassroots movement doesn't really have leaders. They may have organizers and coordinators and be people to answer on behalf to some degree of what's going on. But grassroots is grassroots. It's free. You know, it's free-flowing.
Yeah,
and that's what we're developing.
Right, and we titled this show today, you know, Common Law Grand Jury, the Fourth Branch of Government. And I thought that was really a very appropriate term for common law grand jury.
As a matter of fact, Anton Scalia, he used that particular phrase as a coin, the Fourth Branch of Government. I believe there's a book out there called The Fourth Branch of Government. That might have been where he got that idea, but he did use that in his case. And that's a, you know, it's a good name to some degree, but being a fourth branch of government might give the impression that we're one part of four, where ultimately we are the government. We, the people, did ordain and did establish this Constitution for the United States of America. And as Jefferson said in the Declaration of Independence, we have government by the people. It is by the consent of the people. And this is where we have this. The common law grand jury is the way that the people control both the judicial and the political realms and to make sure that they stay on course and that justice prevails. But they have shut us down. There has been a war in our nation since the very beginning. I was just reading an article which we did post up on our page on nationallibertyalliance.org on our Juris Document page, which about 36 pages. But it gives a really good study and history of the assault upon the grand jury since the very beginning. And it starts off with a justice, I think his name is Wilson, I forget his name, I think it was Wilson, but a Justice Wilson back in 1790, which is 1 year after the Constitution was penned, that you will actually, you know, was accepted. And at that particular lecture that this justice was given was George Washington, who was a supporter of the grand jury. And Thomas Jefferson wasn't necessarily there, but we know he was a great supporter of the Constitution, of the grand jury. It was the grand jury that protected our founding fathers early on when the prosecutors would try to have them put them in jail for subversion and different things, and the people refused to indict or convict. And so they had a very close relationship with that, and the people were involved and understood the power of the grand jury and the trial jury. And so, of course, then they started hijacking the people and bringing them over to England for trial. And, of course, there they would be found guilty. And of course, that was the beginnings of the revolution that was spoken about, as a matter of fact, in the Declaration of Independence, that they were being hijacked and taken to foreign lands in order to be prosecuted. So the battle began in the very beginning.
John, let me ask you a question. And we usually ask this of all of our guests, and I bet I already know what the answer is going to be. But if you could sit down with one historical figure, who would it be and what question would you ask them?
Well, it would be Thomas Jefferson, no doubt, and I would like to know in depth what his understanding of the grand jury was. You know, our founding fathers, they cut their intellectual teeth, so to speak, off of the 17th century philosophers. And, of course, most of that focus was on common law, natural law, and ultimately the Bible. That was the big conversations. And this is what our founding fathers really were reiterating, is what they had learned through the 17th century philosophers. And it was all about freedom, all about man being responsible for himself, stepping up and taking control. And there are three powers that man must deal with. It's spiritual power, political power, and judicial power. Political power controls our destiny. Judicial power controls what kind of a life we're going to have, if we can pursue happiness, if we're going to have peace. And, of course, spiritual power, without that, you don't get the blessings of political or judicial unless you have a bent knee to the governor of the universe.
Yeah, and you know what? And one of the things that I want you to discuss today is you just talked about power. And what we're dealing with, especially in this country and all over the world, actually, is a form of power and control from a ruling elite referred to as the New World Order. For those listeners that are listening for the first time and for those people that are in our overseas audience who may not understand what the New World Order is, can you explain that to them and the seven mechanisms that they are using to control our lives?
Well, yeah, you know, and I think a lot of the people, your other people outside of our country, I think they're very much aware of the New World Order. This effect is going through the whole world because their focus is on the world. The United States has been out there creating democracies for the past 60 or more years, And democracies is just the front set up for oligarchies. So really, we've been creating oligarchies around the world. The United States has been under a dictatorship for quite some time. We just think we're electing these individuals, but they're under total control. And, of course, the New World Order is an elitist group. I don't want to try to define who and what they are. You know, I've heard a lot of different things. But the bottom line, it's only a small group of families, maybe a couple of hundred at most, families that actually control the economic and political realms of the United States and all of and many of many other nations, all of the democracies they've set up, and others. There are other countries, of course, where democracies have not been set up yet. They do have certain control because they control the economic future of these people through the dollar, which is about ready to collapse. And they've woven the fabric of the dollar in every nation across the world, around the world, and for this very purpose, to collapse it and through you know, havoc and you know, just disorder will come the New World Order. But they do control every aspect of our life. They control our political realms, our spiritual realms, of course, our religion, our politics, our law. They control our education, our entertainment system. They control everything. And, you know, we here in the United States, we send our children to school very early. We not only have kindergarten, we have preschool and pre-kindergarten, and we have Head Start, and you have another one. And we send our children in at 3 or 4 years old. So when our children are very young, the enemy has a hold of them and is starting to work on their minds through the educational system that they have created, which is, you know, communist control, top-down type thing. And so they control our education central, and they put into the minds of our children what it is they want, and they keep them there till they're 18. So their entire childhood, they have them more, far more than any parent has them if you're sending your children to school. And our children are being destroyed. They're being taught today. They've got to the point where they're being taught how to live in a militarized zone. Our children go to school and they have to empty their pockets and they're searched and they have to walk through these gates, you know, to put their, you know, see if they have anything on them. They're treated like criminals. And they're used to this, you know, so when they go to an airport, it's just the way life is. And soon they'll be walking down a street going through checkpoints and it's just the way life is. They're preparing them for something. Yeah, and they've been doing that in America, yeah, for a long time now. So we have a huge problem in here in this nation, and I don't believe we have much time left. And if the people are interested in saving the Republic, it's time to stand up now. There is no more time. Either you have to get up and do something now or just brace for the what's coming upon this world. And okay, it's pretty scary. So.
Yeah, we're going to give you an opportunity to relax your voice a little bit. And what I want to do, because we want to get into the Bill of Rights. And so what Susie and I are going to do is we're going to read the Bill of Rights because, like you said, we have a huge overseas audience, and a lot of them don't know what the Bill of Rights are or don't know about that document per se. And I've gotten, since I posted up on Facebook that you were going to be on the show, I got comments that people wanted to know if what we were going to be talking about today, if it would work in their country. And I explained to them that even though common law comes from God, based upon what we're talking about with the grand juries is based upon our Bill of Rights. So therefore, and then later on in the show, I want you to address the overseas audience and what it is that they may be able to do or to start some type of movement in their country. But before we get to that, so that they will know when we talk about the Bill of Rights, we're going to read our Bill of Rights on the air. All right, sir?
Yeah, that sounds good.
And I'll start it off. The First Amendment to the Bill of Rights, it says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievance.
Amendment 2. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Amendment 3, no soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in the time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law.
Amendment 4, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue, but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized.
Amendment 5, and this is the big one, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land of naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, for public property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation.
Amendment 6. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have a compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
Amendment 7. In suits of common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law.
Amendment 8. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted.
Amendment 9. The enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall be construed or to deny or disparage others retained by the people.
Amendment 10. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people.
Now, you guys have just heard the Bill of Rights. And, John, what I would like for you to do is tell us, why were the Bill of Rights added to the Constitution and the purpose they serve versus a tyrannical government?
The Bill of Rights was really the advocate for the Bill of Rights in the very beginning was Thomas Jefferson, and he had said that the people deserved the Bill of Rights. There was some opposition to it, and some people even today think it wasn't necessary, but indeed it was. It's the Bill of Rights that has kept America free. And even to this day, even though all of these 10 amendments, this Bill of Rights has been violated at every level, they still have a fear of it. And if done right in a courtroom, you could put some chills down the spine of a judge. But the Bill of Rights doesn't give us our rights. It really just lays out some of our rights, and it protects our rights. Our rights are unalienable. They come from God. But the Constitution, of course, and the Bill of Rights is part of the Constitution, was written for the United States of America. So in the body of the Constitution, it tells the government what they can do and how they are operating, and obviously if it's not in there, they can't do it. And the Bill of Rights makes it clear what they can't do. And ultimately what they can't do is violate the individual here who is one of the people. And we've taken on kingship here. This is the true American experience. They don't have the authority to write statutes that control our behavior. So when they tell you can't do something, they can't do that. Unless we consent to that, they don't have authority of that. We haven't given them the authority. We, the people, are above the Constitution, and our servant government is below the Constitution. And that includes even the United States Supreme Court, who has acknowledged that many times. They've acknowledged the fact that the people are above them, and that they, when the people make a decision, they can't go against that, no matter what, unless it violates the unalienable rights of another human being. And that's why they say they can't second-guess the decision of any jury, whether it be grand or petite. A grand jury is the operation of the Supreme Court by the people outside of the courtroom, where they start, you know, they could do investigations and negotiate different problems into solutions. Really, they're arbitrators. And if they can settle the matter without having to go to court, then they will do, or they should be doing that. Now, the petite jury, which is the trial jury, if the problem can't be settled, it is then sent into the courts, and it is the petite jury or the trial jury that makes the final decision, both in law and in facts. And the judge is nothing more than just a traffic cop in the court. He's referred to in common law as the magistrate, and not a judge. He might have the reference of the word justice, and therefore is to reflect the will of the king. But the king's bench is actually the jury. If you go into Black's Law Dictionary, you'll discover what's called the king's bench. And the king's bench is where all of the reflectors of the king is, those who reflect the will of the king, which is his justices. And that's the jury. And we, the people, sit on that jury, and we reflect the will of the people, which we find right here in the Bill of Rights particularly. But it goes beyond the Bill of Rights. We have rights beyond what is written there. But they did do a very good job in listing out the important rights. And from these rights, of course, you can see how other rights can emanate from them. And so this is the big battle. And it's the Bill of Rights that gives us the power and the authority in the courts. You know, we go into courts, we make an argument against the other side, and ultimately we're, the judge or the court system brings us under corporate rule and not constitutional rule. And so therefore they have a corporate charter. But the problem they have is they've taken an oath to obey and uphold the Constitution in that court. And that obviously is a conflict with the way what they do, and that's where we go in. When we go into courts, we always make that point in the courts that he has a duty and that he has taken an oath and he has to rule under the Constitution. But on the other end, they got the Bar Association that's got a gun to their heads and forcing them to go another way. And so there's a big conflict in the courts, and until the people step up and take back these courts through the grand juries, we're not going to have justice in the court. And the key thing, you know, that the grand jury does is their job is really to correct any and all wrongdoing that they may find, whether it be in the judicial or political realms, and correct it. And they have the opportunity to correct this without bringing them into courts. They can arbitrate it. And that's key. But, of course, if they fail to comply and they refuse, then they're indicted. And in that indictment, immediately they're removed from office and they have to go to trial and they have to now battle you know, the problem before the trial jury, who will make the final decision on it. But in common law, there are three principles that we must act by in order to get justice. And it governs all of us, and that is that to approach everything with a sense of justice, a sense of honor, and a sense of mercy. And those are the three principles that guide our decision-making. Now, there are also two maxims that also guide us through the courts, and one maxim is in order for there to be a crime, there must be an injured party, and the state cannot be that injured party. So if there is no injured party, there is no crime. So an individual carrying a weapon, obviously it's a right, Second Amendment anyway, but there is no crime involved because they're carrying a weapon to defend themselves or whatever, or if they're driving without a license, that's their business. But of course, they have written laws, or they call them laws, they're actually statutes, to try to control our behavior. But the second thing that drives us, it's a maxim, and that is for every injury, there must be a remedy. So it is the duty of the jury to discover the remedy to reinstate or restore the injured party. And that's the whole focus. And if that could be done without actually going to trial, then that's what the grand jury should be doing. The grand jury and the trial jury is not really interested in putting people in jail and punishing them. It's really there to reinstate the injured party. And the person who injured that person, of course, they're the person that has to restore them. And that, in a sense, becomes a punishment because the rest of the focus of their life until that payment is taken care of is to work towards restoring that individual. And depending on how much damage they've done to them, depends on how long that's going to be. And that's really their you know, the thing that'll be held upon them. not necessarily jail. Jail is for violent people and judges.
Right, and I'm looking at when we talk about the Bill of Rights and we get back to the Fifth Amendment, which establishes common law juries. What was the scope and aim of the Fifth Amendment?
Well, that's interesting because there's no definition of exactly what the grand jury can do. It's up to the people. This is created by the people, and we have history to look to. We have the Magna Carta and what took place in 1215 when we saw the first grand jury in action. And the first grand jury in action back in 1215 was within its infancy, and actually they had a great error going on because they didn't offer the king due process. They were going to take his head right off on the side of the road should he not sign the paper. Of course, that was corrected as a few months went by, and they did rewrite it in order to give the king due process, and also that they wouldn't take the life of the king or his family and so on. So that is the grand jury in its infancy, and before that there is information, but basically that's where we see it really come up in history. They define it as 25 people, and they also get into some of the workings, the working mechanism of the grand jury, where four of the grand jurists might go out to investigate a crime, to see if there's a crime or to investigate a report, and they will work diligently trying to solve the problem. So that they can repair it and move on. And if they can't, then they bring it before the 25, and then the 25 work diligently to solve that problem. And if they can't get an agreement between the two parties, then of course, they send it into trial, and the trial jury makes the final decision for everybody. And that's the process of how it works. We do not find any language anywhere in the Constitution at all about the grand jury. And so the articles of the Constitution defines the legislative power, the administrative power, and the judicial power. But it doesn't define the power of the people. And it's not until we get to the Bill of Rights, where in the Fifth Amendment it speaks of a grand jury, and it leaves it totally open. We have to go into history, as I mentioned. And so the grand jury, as long as they're operating on the three principles that we brought up and guided by those two maxims, they'll never go astray. And as a matter of fact, the common law grand juries that we are establishing across the nation here in America, people are required, and when they become a grand jurist or a trial jurist, either or, that they have to sign a sworn affidavit that they will uphold the principles, that they are accountable to God, and that they have to uphold the principles that we spoke about and the two maxims. And that's our guidelines. And at any time, if you have a person amongst us that is obnoxious or goes beyond what is right, the other 24, or if it's a trial jury, the other 12 or the other 11, could remove that person from amongst them and replace them. And that's why in a grand jury, if you're already in, you can continue in a grand jury, I believe, down to 12. So if you lose people along the way, you can continue. In a trial jury, you must have 12, and usually they have a couple extra wheels, so you'll have two extra people in a grand jury, I think, at minimum, hearing the case in case they lose one or two along the way, so they have to retry the whole case. But anyway, this is the power of the jury, and so it has the authority to question the legislators, the administrative part, even the judges. We can question any one of them. And if we believe they're in wrongdoing, we can indict them and thereby remove them from office immediately. And that's the power of the people. That's true authority, and that's the people standing up doing what they should be doing.
Yeah, and that was granted to us by the Fifth Amendment because it contained those two distinct clauses, which was the grand jury clause and the due process clause.
Well, it was granted to us by God, ultimately. If you go into the Bible, of course, you'll read about this. God speaks about certain things. He even speaks about how to deal with someone who takes a life. You know, he says, if a man takes a life, by man shall his blood be shed. But he goes beyond that, and a lot of people, you have to read through this, and you start to discover he has certain rules about this. If you don't have two eyewitnesses of a murder, then you can't give them the death penalty. So God understood how he created man, and you know, that we could even have a misidentification. But if two people can point out and say, yeah, that's the guy, you're probably a good chance you're right there, and that and other evidence. So there are rules that the Bible has laid out that we can look into. But ultimately, our rights come from God. They're unalienable rights. It's a very important point to make. And that the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, what that does is it secures our rights. And if you read the preamble to the Constitution, it talks about this securing us for, you know, peace and tranquility and so on. But the key thing is it's not codified. Our rights are not codified. But the codifying of our rights through a constitution protects them.
John, I have a question. Just based off what you were saying in this scenario, that for there would have to be two witnesses to say a murder?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, not that they couldn't be convicted of the murder. The point is you can't take the life of a person. They could get life imprisonment. There could be plenty of evidence. But the point is I think what the Bible is making, the point is if you don't have two eyewitnesses, you can't take the life. You can't give them the death penalty.
Right. In the punishment, so to speak.
Correct. Correct.
Now, okay, with how much corruption is going on within our court systems, we're finding out people are, you know, through
it's
DNA.
Worse than you can ever imagine.
Yeah, I know. And so, you know, what if those two witnesses were bought and paid for?
Well, that could be a problem. Our system right now is illegal. As a matter of fact, anybody that's being tried in the system right now can deny jurisdiction and argue that they've never given consent or they've just come to the realization that they don't have to give consent. They can retract their consent and get out of the system on just about every charge because the whole system is illegal. It's operating right now under corporatism. You're going to a corporation to be tried. The state is incorporated. The towns and the cities, the municipalities are all incorporated. Even the United States has been incorporated. And so they're under corporate charter. And they ignore the Constitution. It took me a while to put this together and figure this out. And all my arguments in the courts, and I see what the judges have said and how the lawyers have responded, I finally understand how they're viewing this whole thing. And that's an important point. If you're going to argue a case in court, you need to understand your enemy. But as far as in a system of justice, these kind of things wouldn't be worried about. But in the system we have today, yeah, we have a problem. And they put people to death without even eyewitnesses. And so they've taken that step and gone beyond what God has permitted them to do. And, of course, that's a wrongdoing also. But our intention is to bring common law back into the courtroom. And the only way you can do that is by having a grand jury arise everywhere where there's a courthouse. And in America, there's a courthouse in every county. Every county is required, and they do have a courthouse that's supposed to be under common law. Of course, it's not acting under common law. They've robbed it from us, but we can take it right back. What they did is they infiltrated all of our institutions, and the judicial system is no different. They infiltrated it, and they've taken it over through the Bar Association, and they control everybody through rules, regulations, policies, procedures, statutes. And so they make them do the will of the New World Order, ultimately the minions of the New World Order are lawyers. And so the whole process is run by them. When we go back into the courts, once we get a seat in the court, and we do intend on having that to accomplish that, once we get a seat in the court and we walk into that, we call that judge down to have a conversation with him. And in that conversation, we let him know that we're a nation that's under common law. The United States Constitution requires it. I'm in New York. The New York Constitution requires it, and he has taken an oath to uphold it. Therefore, we're returning to common law. And should he act outside of that common law, that would be a wrongdoing, and we would have to remove him from office and indict him. And as long as he understood that, that's good. Now, he's got three choices. He can obey, and we'll watch him like a hawk. Okay, we're not interested in what he's done in the past. That'll catch up with him later. People will report that, and we'll have to deal with that. But we're interested in what he's doing now and in the future. So he's got that option. He can obey, and we're good with that. He can resign, and we're good with that too. Or he can just tell us to go to hell, and we're good with that, too. We'll just remove him from office and indict him, and he can go argue his case in court, and we'll replace him. It's that simple, and it could be done that quickly. So once that's done in every courthouse, you have 3,141 courthouses or counties across America. Once we can accomplish that in every courthouse, we then have brought common law back into our courts, and we'd be watching them like a hawk and making sure that happens. The second individual that we would deal with after we talk with the judge would be the prosecutor. And he really has no authority at all. He's just hired help. Well, they're all hired help anyway. But in any event, he's a simple guy. We just let him know, no uncertain terms, that you can't use a puppet grand jury. Don't call for one. If you need a grand jury, give us a call. Here's our number, and we'll deal with it. But don't bring us these cases, and we'll give them a list of cases not to bring them because they're not breaking the law. And, you know, make sure you can find an injured party before you come see us. And but should you go and hire yourself or try to pull out a puppet grand jury, then we'll have no choice but to indict you also, and we'll just replace you too. The third individual that the grand jury would be dealing with would be the sheriff. And the sheriff is just a lost soul. You know, they're politicians and they're law enforcement, but they do have a different attitude because they're holding the office of the sheriff. And they're trying to do the right thing, but they're ignorant. They're as dumb as we are, and we need to bone up on natural law, and they need to also. So we wrote a book called The Jurist Handbook. It's online. You can go up to our webpage, again, nationallibertyalliance.org, and on our jurist document page, you'll see a copy of that. You can download it. Eventually we'll have a small one. We'll sell, you know, pocket type like the Constitution booklets. But anyway, we wrote a book, and it lays out everything they need to know. If they can bone up on that book and they understand what's in that book, they'll know everything they need to know to be able to do their job as a sheriff. And they also have to bring the militia. Well, we the people have to bring the militia back. At least here in New York, the militia has been shut down. So we'll put them under the wing of the sheriff for a while, because these are strange times, and let the sheriff be the authority for that until we pass by these hard times, and then the people will take it back. but we need to get the militia going through, and that'll give it the authority by you putting it under the sheriff and getting the blessings from the grand juries. And we've unified the grand juries. We're acting as one here in New York, and we're training other people in other states to act as one. You got to come together. You work in your own county. You do what has to be done. But on a state level, you come together as one. And when you sign a paper against something at a state level, then every grand jury in the state will sign it and be sealed with their seal. And I think that would be a very strong message to our legislators within our state and even the administration within and the court system within our states. So you know, this is how we take it back. Once that's done, the republic has been saved, and business can go forward.
Right, and I just want to say this, because there's two things that you mentioned that people need to be aware of, and like I said, I have to be cognizant of the fact that we have an overseas audience. He mentioned the preamble to the Constitution, and for those of you over in our overseas audience and also, maybe for those of you who are listening in the States who don't understand what the preamble to the Constitution is, what the preamble to the Constitution says, and that's where the term "we the people" come from, because it's what it states is we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. That's what the preamble says. That's where the term "we the people" come from, and that's who we are, and that's what he's talking about. You're on with John listening to the Talk with Vince show, and we're on with John Duresh, and we're talking about taking back our republic, because we're not a democracy. We are a republic, and it's we the people, for the people, by the people, of the people. And that preamble to the Constitution means we the people. And when you're talking about common law grand juries, that Fifth Amendment establishes that grand jury. And the other thing that I want to mention here, that important thing that you said, was about the sheriff, because the sheriff is an elected official, and he is the highest authority of law enforcement in the land. A lot of people don't know that. Even he's even above the federal government and their puppet agencies.
Exactly. Any ABC agent that comes into the county must get approval by the sheriff to continue. And if the sheriff overrules them, they're out of there and they can't do anything about it. And that's the way it was set up. The sheriff was originally... you know, you can trace that back, of course, back into 1100, 1200 AD, maybe even earlier. But the sheriff was the king's police force. They enforced, the sheriff and the bailiff enforced the will of the king. The bailiff enforced the will of the king within the court, and the sheriff enforced the will of the king outside the court. And nothing has changed. The bailiff is there to work for the king, and the king certainly is not the government. The king is the people. And the same thing with the sheriff. The sheriff is there to work for the king. You know, two things I'd like to just go through quickly. I'd like to just read one or two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, which was written by Thomas Jefferson. And the other thing I'd like to just maybe make a statement concerning how common law could flow to the rest of the world. But first, here, these two paragraphs we read in the Declaration of Independence. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth separate and equal stations to which the laws of nature and of nature's gods entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the cause which impelled them to this separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And that's the grand jury. The grand jury consents to those who are governing us, because we are the authority, and we can give that authority, and we can take that authority. Now, the key thing is this, you know, justice is the key light of the grand jury. Justice is a word, if you look it up in Black's Law Dictionary or even Bouvier's dictionary, you will discover that they define justice as being synonymous with virtue. And virtue, of course, flows out from God. You'll read about that in the New Testament. Whatever things are good, whatever things are just, whatever things are of good report, you know, think on these things and so on. So that's where justice comes from. It comes from virtue. And that is what that's the light that must be held up. And if you're going to hold up the light of justice, you're going to be holding up the light of God. You're going to be holding up His word. You're going to be holding up the governor of the universe before all men and be doing the right thing. If once we get that through the United States, the rest of the world will seize upon this. You know, Europe used to be common law. I don't know if they still are. England used to be common law. Canada used to be common law. You know, many of the much of the free world has been common law or has a relationship with it. But I am sure, I am convinced, and you know, the UCC is really supposed to be governed by common law also. Which is the Universal Commercial Code, which works among nations. It brings us to some civility. But there are rules at sea and so on that we all agree upon concerning pirates and different things. And that's what they use against us here on the land, unfortunately, which takes away our unalienable rights. But the bottom line, though, is if freedom rings again in America and goes forward and justice prevails and we lift up the light of justice again, then that'll be only because of the blessings of God. And that can flow to any and every nation, and I think a lot of nations will jump right on board. If America had been doing the thing it was supposed to have been done, unfortunately we've been infiltrated from the very beginning, and we've never really accomplished the true goal that America really wanted to put forward. But if it was to accomplish that, it's exactly that, justice for all. And anybody who comes to America, or anybody who might be... picked up on a battlefield. Every person has unalienable rights. Nothing is removed from them if they come under the justice of America, because all men are created equal. And under all circumstances, we have the right of due process, even in war. We might not be able to get it that quickly. We have to wait, but justice should come to all.
And John, let me ask, because you've mentioned God several times, Christianity, what role did Christianity play in the framing of the Constitution?
Well, the Bible Let's talk about common law. Common law really is Mosaic law, and it's been around since the very beginning. You know, thou shalt not kill. The law came, and we were slain by the law. And, of course, that's because the hearts of men are desperately wicked. Who could know it? And so it's an ongoing battle within ourselves to do the right thing. And those of us, by the mercy of God, that have able to succeed in that battle and do the right thing and make the right choices, again, it's only by His mercy. But the bottom line, ultimately, is common law comes from the Bible. And it shines forth in Mosaic law, the first five books of the Bible. You'll read about it. And God even sets up the system. Our system is set up exactly as Mosaic law has been set it up, you know, families of tens and judges and so on and so forth, and it's ruled by people. So our founding fathers, when they set this up, they received an understanding of knowledge of common law from England, obviously. And it was back in about 400 A.D. When the Anglo-Saxons came to England, and they brought with them this idea to be ruled over by the mind of God and not the mind of man. And back in those days, they were looking for maxims, and they wanted to be governed by truth, which they found in what's called maxims. And so they look at the facts, and they relate the maxims to them, and they make a decision, and they believe that that was ruled by God. And a maxim, for instance, is a statement that cannot be denied, that everyone agrees upon. For instance, water cannot go uphill. That's a simple one, unless you put a pump on it, of course. But water cannot flow uphill. And nobody can argue that point. A thing similar isn't necessarily the same thing. All men are created equal. You see, those are maxims. They cannot be argued. And everyone agrees to the conclusion that it gives when it's stated. And so this is the way they looked to rule, be ruled by. They didn't want to be ruled by men. Okay, and when they came to England, they discovered the Bible. They also didn't believe that you couldn't write the law down because the law is different under every circumstance, and all that is true. But when they came to England, they did find the Bible, and they fused to the Bible. They believed that the Bible was written by God, and they believed that that was the only written law that should be obeyed. And so, therefore, that was the birth for England and in America of common law. The dukes and the freemen, okay, they were free, and they ordained a king. And the king, they put the sovereignty into one person, a king. And when the king would sit on his bench, he would always rule on behalf of the freemen. He would represent them in the courts. And the final word of the king was it. You know, his wish is all as everyone's command. And so he would represent them. And that was their purpose. And they understood their purpose. But from time to time, we'd get a bad king, and they'd go off the plantation, so to speak, and start doing crazy things. And this is the problem they had back in 1215. And so they threatened the king's life. Those 25 people were dukes or freemen. They were supposed to be represented by the king, and they were being... Actually, they were having problems with the king. He wasn't doing his job. And so that's why they pulled him off the side of the road and they made him sign the paper, which is the Magna Carta. And we inherited that from there. But what we did is we did something a little different. And this is the great American experiment, is that everyone's a king. You know, it's not the authority or the sovereignty isn't in the state. It isn't. It isn't in an individual. It isn't in a judge. It is in each and every one of us. We are the kings of the court. The sovereign of the court rules the court. And when you walk into a court, if you're the sovereign or the only conscious sovereign, then you actually get to rule the court. So you know, if you go in and take someone to court on a contract or something, let's say, and the other side is brain dead and doesn't understand to become to get a jury to make the solution for the case, or they don't understand to countersue you as a plaintiff, and then there has to be a jury, and they don't understand that, and they're brain dead to that, then at the end of the case, the sovereign gets to decide. So the person that sued them gets to decide the solution and the end results, and it's held up. That's it. That's common law.
That's common law.
Of course, once everybody realizes
that. John, hold up. Let me stop you right there. We're going to have to take a break.
Sure.
And this will give you an opportunity to go wet your palate, and what we'll do is we'll call you back because it's going to be about 5 minutes.
Sounds good.
And then when we come back on the other side, I want to get into the authority of the grand juries and the common law grand juries and your take on that. And you, my God, you're a wealth of knowledge. And I want to direct people to the website. It's nationallibertyalliance.org. That's nationallibertyalliance.org. nationallibertyalliance.org, because you have a wealth of information and education on that website. And, you know, the reason why I wanted to ask you about the historical figure was because the quotes from Thomas Jefferson, and I think what we're doing today, I want to read this quote: educate and inform the whole mass of people. They are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back on the other side, we're going to come back with John Duresh, and we're going to be talking about authorities of the grand jury and common law grand juries. All right.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.